see a few faces I might not have seen before, so I just introduced myself. I'm Monk George, which I, where I live in north of Asheville, people ask, what should we call you? And I said, just call me Monk George. My Tibetan name is too complicated and no other titles. So in a preparation for the talk tonight, I thought we might do a little meditation on what I had introduced last time, and that will be even though you might be a little bit uncertain. Do any of you have this book? Or do all of you have this book? None of you have this book. Okay. It is available in the bookstore, and it is an exceptional gem. It is teachings by the Dalai Lama, translated by one of the best of the Western translators, Jeffrey Hopkins, from UCB at University of Virginia. And it is just a real gem. And I think your teacher, Steep, where's Steep? Is she here? There she is, in back. She said that she memorized the verses of this, if I understood correctly. Right? They're the root verses. So in this text, and as you probably don't have it with you there, there are this meditation that I mentioned last time was called the nine round meditation. That's an abbreviated version, right? We'll try to calm our mind a little, and we'll just introduce that in meditation, and you get an idea how to do that. So sit comfortably. Make a nice sigh if you need to. Relax your body. Relax your neck, your shoulders, your arms. Kind of scan your body down. Let the tension flow out. And then relax your mind. As a preparation, I like to think you could just remind yourself, you don't have to think about anything else right now. Even if you have an idea for a better mousetrap that was the classic in the old days. Just, you can address that later. Worries about the past, plans about the future, let go. And first, just watch your breathing without controlling it. Recognizing when you're breathing in, when it's changing direction, when it's breathing out, as though your whole mind absorbs into that, so there's nothing else other than that as your object of observation. Hopefully you're a little bit successful in calming the mind. with watching the breathing. Now, focus just your mind on a more subtle subject, more subtle object, the nature of the mind itself within which you're thinking, like a vast space, clear sky within which clouds can come, clouds can absorb back into it, dissolve into this space as they evaporate. Birds can fly without obstruction, as though there might be sort of bird-like thoughts passing through your mind, maybe circling, cloud-like images or thoughts remaining for some time. Rather than focusing on the thoughts, the objects within this spaciousness, see if you can focus on the space between the thoughts. Clear space that allows them to be present and move without obstruction. That's the nature of your mind, conventional nature of your mind. Peaceful. Clear. Illuminating. Not only between the thoughts, so to speak, is there space, but even where the thoughts are present, if you recognize they could only be present if there were space, the spaciousness of the mind there, the clear light nature of the mind. So taking your attention away from the object thought to the subjective mind within which it's arising. Letting go of thoughts again and again. Let go of the appearance of your body that might be still seemingly irrefutable there, looming, so to speak. That's just an appearance to your mental consciousness. Withdraw your attention away from the body like a turtle withdrawing its arms and legs and head into its shell. Even let go of the sense of yourself as an observer of the mind. Actually, that sense of a self which is the observer is an illusion from the Buddha's point of view. Just become mind. Just let yourself dissolve into that spaciousness. It has no particular color, although you might have been imagining a color. If a color appears to your mind, let go of that and sense the clear spaciousness of the mind within which that was arising. It has no shape, no form. This is our resource that, to encourage us when things are bad, that within this space we can develop all of the good qualities and eliminate from our mind all negative habits and impulses, because they are not part and parcel of the mind. The mind is like this clear, light nature, not stained by any of our afflictions of anger, attachment, hatred, ignorance, jealousy. And what one like myself would do is remind myself something like this. Up until now, this lifetime, I practiced spiritual teaching sporadically, interested sometimes caught up in worldly activities. That lack of consistency and intensity of practice is due to not remembering the meditation on death and impermanence. So there's three main outlines. The first one is that death is certain. Death is definite. Although we'd probably be ridiculed by most people if we said we weren't sure that we were going to die. That hasn't really reached the level of a realization in our mind, something that we are know deeply and intimately all the time. Why is it definite we're going to die? There are three sub-reasons here that are given. One, death comes to everyone and there is no way to avoid it. So see if you can think of anyone in history, in the past, who you knew lived and didn't die. Even the Buddha took the aspect of dying. Christ sacrificed himself on the cross, died. Gandhi, Mother Teresa, bad people, also Hitler, Stalin. Death comes to everyone. People in your family who've passed away. Maybe if one of your moms, mom or dad, or grandfather or grandmother have died while you were alive. Like that, death comes to everyone. I'm exactly the same. I will die. Even thinking of maybe your brothers or sisters or your spouse right now who's healthy and happy. To recognize they will get older. They will die eventually. There's no way to avoid it. The Buddha said there's no place you can go in space, in the earth, anywhere, where you can avoid the inevitability of death, the certainty of death. Now apply that to yourself. Think, I'm like all these people of the past, even the much more spiritually advanced people than myself have passed away. I'll have to die. What that means is leaving the vision of this life, your family, friends, possessions, recognizing that now as inevitable, as definite, can really change your behavior. Not being so caught up in just the appearance of the present, with a mind that grasped to its permanency, to the permanency of myself, to the permanency of relationships. All of that has to be left behind. I myself will die one day, because death has come to everyone and there's no way to avoid it. And then intensify that with another thought, another reason. Death is definite because the time that we have left remaining is constantly eroding, sort of like the grains of sand in a, what do they call it, sand clock. Sun, was it? Yeah, whatever that was.
Hourglass.
Hourglass. Like that, every instant, we're getting closer to death. It's not as though you can call time out, get extra time, you know, so like the clock stops. And it's a subsidiary of that, the same second reason. We're constantly approaching death, and at the time of death, there's no opportunity to argue with the Lord of Death, so to speak, or to ask for some extra time. All of the years of our life when we don't practice at the time of death, we might wish, oh, I want to practice now, but there may not be any time. We may actually die before we can actually practice. If you're out running, you can think like this. I'm consuming this distance between my feet as I'm striding forwards or walking. In my case, I'm walking. I'm not running any longer. Every step, I'm getting closer to my destination in the same way. Every moment, shortest moment, I'm getting closer to death. Because we're constantly approaching it, and there's no way to extend the time when we reach that end, we're definitely going to die. Now apply that to yourself. I'm going to die. Because even in the shortest instance, I'm getting closer to death. Who knows? Even the youngest person in this room might only live another 50 years or 60 years. No, I'll give you 70. So the older ones, we might have another couple of years or a decade, but definitely that time is consumed with every shortest instant. There's no time when we're not getting closer to death. So we will definitely finish. Third reason to bring about a realization of this fact that we're definitely going to die, that death is certain, is called a reason of experience. It doesn't sound like a logical reason, as in the Dalai Lama's book it says, because when we are alive, there is little time to practice. Just to contemplate on that, it helps to understand. For instance, we might spend, a third or more of our life in sleep. And maybe the first 10, 15 years of our life, 20 years, even longer, as a child, there was no thought of practicing the Dharma. When we get very old, there might be some period of time when we are unable to practice, we become too feeble, our mind becomes unclear. And even the time in between when we could practice, it's involved with our making money, preparing meals, getting the food, preparing it, eating it. Accumulating friends, making money. Very little time we can imagine to practice the Dharma. So death will certainly find us in this situation. Just thinking of that helps to bring that point to mind. I'm definitely going to die. If it were not definite that we're going to die, if we might live forever, we might not have to practice the Dharma. But from a Buddhist perspective, when we die, this is not the end. When we definitely die, our mind will continue in another form through the intermediate state. And that future life depends on our practice of the Dharma now, what we experience. Of course, it depends on the actions we did in previous lives. Also, those karmic seeds in our mind stream. But we can have with a very strong practice of Dharma now, spiritual practice, we can make a very strong imprint to sort of, you almost can sense the shape of our future practice. So as a conclusion of these three points, that these three reasons to prove that death is definite, one comes to the conclusion, I must practice the Dharma. Because death is certain. Like being at a train station in India, waiting for the train. Some people might not know that the train is eventually going to come. It takes so long, it's late. But rather than spending your time decorating the waiting room, which you might do, someone who recognizes that you're definitely going to have to leave this station is definite. You can see the analogy here. Not so concerned about just the temporal location you are in right now, the train station or the events of this lifetime, but preparing for the future lives by practicing what can be useful for the future. The practice of Dharma. Is a second main topic. Death, not only is death definite, the very time that we die is, from our point of view, totally uncertain. Beings with clairvoyance or the Buddhas can tell when we're going to die, we'll know when we're going to die, but we have no idea. It could be in this very meditation room tonight. It could be on the way home. It could be next week. How can we bring our mind to get to some taste of that? Well, there are three reasons for that. The time of death is uncertain. One, because in our world system, human beings, living beings that we are a member of, this human rebirth, have no definite lifespan. You know, people that have died when they were children, some of them even in the womb, abortions or other kinds of disasters, when they were young, teenagers, out for to see the movie, get hit by a car, take drugs, whatever. Sometimes without any accidents, people, their lifespan just finishes. They, while washing the dishes with their partner, they drop dead in the kitchen. We don't know when we're going to die. If that's the case, wouldn't it make more sense to use every moment that we have rather than procrastinating the practice of Dharma? Because it's uncertain, we should practice now. Like falling through space in an elevator, knowing that eventually it's going to crash into the ground, using every moment that you have to prepare yourself for the future life. Another reason to bring the mind to understand that the time of death is uncertain is that our body is very fragile. Unlike a big, heavy steel box that you might be have the movers bring into your office or your house or wherever, pulling it through the hallways, hitting the walls, the banisters, maybe some steel things. Even that steel box will get banged up a little bit. But we, through our everyday experience, because our body is very fragile, unlike that substantial steel box, we can be bitten by a deer tick, come down with a very debilitating disease, or even a mosquito, even a small thorn on a rose plant that happens to have some substances on it, either organic or inorganic substances that can poison us. Like Nagarjuna said, like a lamp or a candle, you could say, uncovered, left on your front porch, on your front step. When there's no wind, that might remain for a long time, burning, but it can, before it uses up its fuel, uses up its lifespan, so to speak, because it's fragile, that flame of the candle, it can be blown out by a breeze, it can be kicked over by someone because it's just a little lamp. It's not sort of super stable like a big boulder that has a little wick coming out of it. And the third reason to think that the time of death is indefinite is that there are actually more causes of death than there are causes of life. We might think that food is a cause of life. To a certain degree, that's true. But food can be also a cause of death. You can choke on the food. You can have an allergic reaction. We might think that our car is a cause of life because it allows us to go to work and make money and pay the bills so that we can live. That car can become the cause of our death. The causes of life are very few, just a little bit of air that we can breathe, a modicum of protection from the elements, you know, some warmth, blankets, or a little room protect you from the cold or the heat. And of course, food, air, water, and some warmth. Many, many other things that we think of as essential to our lives. The newest gadget, the newest movie. Indulging in them can actually, eventually, due to accidents or something else, they can cause our life to cease. See if you can get a feeling of this, that yes, indeed, my death is certain. I'm going to die. But beyond that, I could die at any time. There's no certainty that the time of death as a human in this world system. The body is very fragile. Diseases and so forth. And there are more causes of death than there are causes of life. I could die at any time. The positive conclusion one would make from this is that not only must I practice the spiritual path, the Dharma, I should practice it now rather than putting it off, because I could die before I get to the point of practicing. If you were to go to the apartment or the home of someone who had just passed away, even if they were old, but let's say if they're, you know, they died unexpectedly, if you looked in their closet, you would see probably some clothes that were never worn, that they were bought with the anticipation of wearing later, that there was money in their bank account that they had anticipated using for vacations or whatever, tickets to events that they anticipated going to, but they died before that. The time of death is uncertain, so I must practice now, this very day, tonight, before I go to bed. What is the prayer, childhood? If I should die before I wake. And the third main outline on this 9-round meditation on death is that the only thing that helps when we die, at the time of death, is our Dharma practice, in the sense of the virtuous energy that we created through practice of this life, and also the ability to control the mind at that time, to not cling on to this life, to be able to let go. At the time of death, our body that we've fed with the best chocolate and pizza and sushi and peanut butter and champagne and not just bottled water, the better bottled water. This body that we've put so much attention to in yoga classes and diets and creams and massages, it's of no use to us. It has to be left behind. We can't take it with us, not even one atom, a molecule. If you know that deeply, that you're going to die, that you could die at any moment, and that you can't, at the time of death, the body doesn't aid you. It actually hinders you because of your attachment, fear of leaving it. You can begin to treat the body more as just like a boat that can help you to get across the ocean of samsara. At the time of death, also our friends and relatives don't help. Only thing that helps at the time of death is the Dharma. Why don't our relatives help? Our friends? They might be there beseeching us, don't die, don't leave us, crying, or in some extreme cases, asking you who's going to get your, who's going to get the biggest part of your will, causing your mind to be very depressed. Your relatives can't go with you. They're not your companions into the next life from a Buddhist perspective. And thirdly, your wealth and power have to be left behind. Unlike the belief of the pharaohs, where they would put wealth in the pharaoh's tomb that in theory they could utilize in the next life. You know, slaves even were entombed with them as though they would be some support in the future life. We can't take any of our power or possessions with us. If you come to think of it, you know, the body that we cultivated, the friends that we spent so much time cultivating, and our possessions and wealth we amassed, none of that can help at the time of death. The only thing that helps is our ability to control the mind due to the practice of Dharma and the dharmic instincts that we've left in our mind, the karmic seeds that we've left in it. That we can take to the future life. So the conclusion of this one thinks, I should only practice the Dharma. I should practice only the Dharma. The first death is definite. The conclusion was I must practice. The time of death is indefinite. Conclusion, I must practice now. Recognizing that nothing except the Dharma helps at the time of death, the conclusion is I must practice only the Dharma. Integrate it into your life, whatever you do. Whether you're washing the dishes, going to work, always integrating that with the practice of the Dharma. So with a little taste of that, think that this evening, with what time is left, I'm going to listen to the talk tonight on impermanence and death with the thought of that understanding enhancing my Dharma practice so that I'll practice Dharma, I'll practice it now and without procrastinating and try to make it a pure practice of Dharma, just integrating it into all of our life. And then relax, bring your attention back to the present. What was that? Is that a long time meditation? Is that longer than you've meditated before? Okay. Yeah. Did you feel a little bit tired, frustrated? No? Oh, well, that's good. I would have thought someone would have been... Any observation? What we just did together is what you might call a guided meditation. So it doesn't mean that you have to ask someone for a recording in order to do this again in the future. That's an example of what you should be saying to yourself and dwelling on those points which are most tasty to you, or those points where they're more difficult, where you have to spend more time thinking about it, using your own reasons. Sometimes you can read texts, Buddhist texts, that delve into more reasons for this, examples, you know, like you have a big, you go to Costco and you get a big jar of coffee, and at first, the first spoonful, you say, oh, wow, I've got a whole, you know, a lot of coffee, no problem. And the next time, you don't notice so much. After a couple of days, you have to put the spoon down a little bit further. The level's gone down, and then, you know, eventually, what do you think? Is that coffee going to end? Of course. You know that from your own experience, although at first, because it seems so plentiful, you don't see the end. The time of death is uncertain. With just the coffee example, you never know. Maybe someone got into your apartment and borrowed some coffee, so the next time you go in, you thought there was going to be some coffee, but it's uncertain the time it ends. Maybe just tonight when you go back, because I got into your apartment and made lots of coffee. So many, many examples you can think of. I remember when I was in high school in Chicago, I didn't play these heavy sports, football and basketball and baseball, but the team was known, the school was known for its sports. And there was some trick, I think all teams do this, you know, near the end of the game, there's only a couple seconds, maybe a minute left, and one of our players would fall down on the ground, moaning in pain, so the referees would call timeout, right? We didn't have any timeouts left, so like extra time. There's no extra time with life. You know, when death comes, you can't just petition some referee or St. Peter or someone for some extra time. I always wanted to practice. Now I realize it. Just give me 5 more minutes. I told you the story about the Italian telecom commercial. Those are my favorite commercials. When I was at the monastery in Italy, the monks would watch what they call football. We call soccer, right, at night. And the Italian telecom had this great series of commercials. This guy was about to be executed by the French Foreign Legion. You know the scene, right? The soldiers are there, and there's some colonel with his little whip. And the person who's going to be shot is asking for just one, you know, just one last, you know, what is it in the movies? One last cigarette or, you know, something. So he says, I just want to call Mama. So and it's a Verizon or whatever it was, Italian telecom. So he's talking to his mom. He says, Mama, you know, without this phone, I'd be dead. I thought that was such a... So cute. Without this phone, yeah, he'd literally be dead, because as soon as the phone call is over, they're going to shoot him. So if you have interest to get this book, which I would suggest very much, someone said there's some in the bookstore, this meditation, the outline of this is about in the middle of it. It's on page... I have to put my glasses on to see. Page 92, I think, or what does it say here? 92, 93. You see these outlines. And you can find it also in many other Buddhist texts. This especially is a meditation of the Kadampa Lamas, the Geshes, the followers of Atisha, who is this statue to my left, who was a great Indian who came to Tibet around, I'm not sure, 1000, about the same time as Marpa, the translator, was going to India to study and so forth. And he revitalized the Buddhism that had been, had reached a point of a little bit of rocky time. His followers were called the Kadampas. And that's the name of our center, Kadampa Center. So, those followers had sort of enshrined this 9-round meditation on death. So it's very appropriate for us to be familiar with it at the Kadampa Center. So I'm going to speak a little bit more, but before I do, let me open up to any observations or questions you may have from what we've been talking about last time or what I've talked about tonight. I have a question, actually. Are you two sisters? You and the... No? No, okay. You look just like out of affection, you've come to look like each other.
I just want to know what the name of the book is.
This edition is called Mind of Clear Light, Advice on Dying and Living a Better Life. Oh, earlier editions were just Advice on Dying and Living. It's on the syllabus?
Yeah, it's on the About Discovering Buddhism handout that was available last week and outside the Gampa door this week. It's under the readings. Yeah, it's the book that's listed under the readings.
So this is a series of teachings by His Holiness the Dalai Lama on this topic of death and dying, using a text by another great Lama called the Panchen Lama in Tibet, who is also the author of the book the subject we'll be studying next weekend, the Mahamudra on Meditation on Emptiness, the Panchen Lama. So the Dalai Lama is commenting on text by the first Panchen Lama, 17 stanzas on dealing with death and the intermediate state and rebirth. So, okay, that was one question. Anyone else have a comment or observation? Yes, sir. You have to train Charlie to...
Last week you went over the four seals, and I've got the three of the four. I got all compounded phenomena are impermanent, all contaminated phenomena are suffering, and the fourth, nirvana is bliss. Can you just restate the third, please?
The third is all phenomena are empty and void.
Selfless
and empty. Better to say it that way. Selfless and empty. So the first one is qualified all compounded phenomena. The second was all contaminated phenomena. Here, all phenomena, without exception, are selfless and empty.
Thank you.
So in some of the earlier Buddhist traditions in India, they said all phenomena are impermanent, not recognizing that some things were permanent. All phenomena were suffering. Actually, from a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha experience is not suffering. That's a phenomena. For instance, there are other phenomena like that that are not suffering. But all phenomena are empty and selfless, and the state we call nirvana is a cessation of all the suffering, is bliss. Good. Anyone? I've mentioned in other courses when I taught in Tokyo one time at a center there. During the course, I asked people if they had any questions, and Japanese are a little bit hesitant. They don't like to lose face. Is that the right term? Very quiet. Couldn't get, drag out an answer from them. After the course, it was a weekend seminar, it wasn't long. they came to me and said, Bhante, we'd like to have a party, you know, to celebrate the end of the course. I said, oh, okay, well, that's okay. They said, but Bhante, we'd like to have sake at the party. I said, what's sake? There's some kind of alcoholic drink, right? Have you ever had sake? Yes. Okay. So I said, well, Buddhist perspective, that's not, and they cut me off. They said, but Bhante, we always have sake. So I was been in a bind, said, okay, I'm not going to partake, but you can have, they were lay people. And during the party, after a little while, they came up to me with so many questions. It's like the inhibitions had been, so when in a crowd like this, if people feel a little shy to ask questions, I say, pass the sake. You know, feel yourself like you've had a shot of good Japanese sake or Jack Daniels or not a Shirley Temple. I understand Shirley Temple is not alcoholic, right, Don? No. Okay. Anyone feel okay? Good. Sake has been passed. This. You know, okay. Both. There's a lady in the back row and also this gentleman. He's going to say ladies first. Okay.
Hello.
Okay.
So we're talking about observations during the meditation, right?
Yes.
And so I kind of go back to this experience I had earlier this year where we're at the beach, we're having a great time, and my son starts floating out, and I'm literally about to drown trying to save him. And so in that moment, I didn't feel attachment for myself. I felt the attachment for him.
Right.
And not the sense of him drowning, because I felt like he would be okay, because I had moved him far enough away, but the wave just took me under and I could feel myself floating out and drinking all this and healing all this water. But it was the attachment of leaving them there defenseless. Like, I was the only adult. And if I would have drowned, they would have been there by themselves. And so every time I meditate, I try to deal with the attachment, but it's not for myself. So that's the observation I felt.
Yeah. There's a lot to work with there. Yeah. We, in when we care for others and we even sacrifice our own comforts and even possibly our life for others, that's from a Buddhist perspective a very ennobling thought. You know, it leaves an imprint in our mind to even go further in future lives to work for the welfare of others. But what we want to do also from a Buddhist perspective is to make our that altruistic thought, something that's not biased. If it had been someone else, also for me, if it had been my friend or my child, I would have, but if it was someone else, I was a lifeguard. And I wouldn't have gone out myself to do that. That's the difference of, in Buddhism, the differentiation between what we call compassion and great compassion. Great compassion takes the responsibility on ourself to help all living beings. So that, from my point of view, what you demonstrated was an act of compassion, but it was, like all of us now, it was just the beginning stage because it was by, I assume that you wouldn't have gone out if there was a stranger out there or something like that. So there's a lot to unpack in that, and that's good.
I guess the reason why I was asking is more of dealing with the letting go of the attachments, right?
Right.
And so.
So that's one of the main subjects of this book and the meditation on death and impermanence, to recognize the things that we are attached to will inevitably change. Let's say parents, yourself. I don't know how old your child is now. You seem young, so it can't be very old. If parents have don't have a sense of change and impermanence. They don't envision that their child is going to grow up. It's very, very difficult when the child leaves home, even as they're growing up. The meditation on impermanence and death is something that can help us to overcome attachment. My teacher, Lama Yeshe, used to say, and I'd mentioned this in the talk the other day, other than the realization of the ultimate reality, emptiness, ultimate truth, other than that, which is a universal antidote to our delusions, meditation on emptiness is right up there, even though it's much easier to realize in impermanence than to realize emptiness. Still, it's very, very powerful. So when we have attachment, let's say to an individual, to a friend or a child, just to recognize we're changing every second, in the shortest instant, we're changing. The other individual is changing. If there's attachment to, let's say, in a sensual sense, to a partner, a companion, you know, that they will, that which you find attractive right now will change also. The body won't always be so firm and, smooth and moist. I gave example the other day of the flower. Did I tell you this? Meditation? The great Thai master had told us to put a flower cut from the garden, so it's no longer organically, you know, connected to the roots. Put it in a bowl of sand in our tea room, and as the days of, it was like a weekend that he was there, just watch that flower as time goes on. And at first there's a little brown spot, and one of the leaves begins to, you know, the droop, and then there's a no longer smells nice, starts to rot. Like that, it's inevitable that those things that we're attached to will change. Of course, if your connection with another individual is based on deeper things than skin deep, you know, you've developed a respect and understanding for them as your companion, partner. That doesn't matter. But for many people, that's a cause. There's an expression I hear sometimes, oh, my husband traded me on for a newer model or something like that. Or my wife traded me in for her tennis coach or something like that. You know, so something younger because I don't look in the way that I looked when, you know, we got together. So the meditation on impermanence can help in many, many different ways. And as I mentioned last time, when I say impermanence, generally I'm talking about subtle impermanence, the momentary change, moment by moment. And to understand that, we have to understand the gross impermanence, like of our life. That's why these two topics, death and impermanence, are often linked together. Death is an example of gross impermanence of ourself. Okay. And then this gentleman, you had a question? Yeah.
So it's, I struggle with this, and maybe it's just perspective. I don't know if it has an answer. So here's the bottom line. So I'm in my 50s, practicing about, I don't know, 45 years. So in this life.
You've been practicing 45 years since you were.
No, 4 or 5 years.
Oh, 4 or 5. So that's no, no, no. Great.
Well, that's part of my question. Yeah. So, you know, I believe this path. Okay.
Yes.
Let's just
okay.
Leave it at that.
Okay.
But what I struggle with is, okay, so here comes the next life. Let's just say I get a human rebirth, right? You're talking about, you know, the time to practice Dharma is precious and blah, 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 and all that stuff.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
So let's say I'm born in a human life again. Let's just say I am. And then, so what's to say in the next life I'm going to practice the Dharma at the age of 10? So, because the purpose of this is to keep advancing. So how do you think about that I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah, you're making very good sense. So when we talk about that particular subject of what we call the life of leisure and endowment, or in short, perfect human rebirth. I understand acronym was it PHR, perfect human. So I was at dinner the other night, and I said, oh, the PHR. And I said, what is that PHR? The Kadampa Center has all these acronyms for Buddhist phrases. I don't think the Tibetans ever did that. But what is the cause of a perfect human rebirth? Well, it's said that its main cause is to be avoid negative karma and create positive karma. We say pure ethics. Okay, that's the main cause, to be born in the upper realms. Then to have the subsidiary endowments, wealth, enough food, enough, you know, things like that, due to the practice of generosity. Actually, in all the six perfections, but particularly generosity. And the third cause of a perfect human rebirth is strong prayer. To wish very much to be born again as a human, not just so that you can enjoy human pleasures, you know, that you might, next life I'll have, because I've practiced morality, I'll be more attractive, I've been generous, I'll be wealthy, I'll have lots of friends, I'll be powerful. Not like that, but to be able to, again, to be born as a human, to practice with those essential ingredients that make your practice powerful. So how can we, you know, you might say, I never read any prayers like that. Generally what it means is when we develop the thought of bodhicitta, you've heard of bodhicitta, maybe some of you, that itself has within it the thought of however long I will work to achieve enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings, that has within it the most perfect kind of dedication and prayer to be born as a human. So if you, in this lifetime, you take, you know, you practice bodhicitta, you try to meditate on that, and try to develop good heart to come back to help others, the bodhisattva ideal of working for the sake of others, that itself has within it that essential cause of praying, wishing, aspiring to be born as a human. As someone said the other day, so that in the next life you can hit the ground running. Yeah, we said, I think someone said that last time. So that, like, next, rather than encountering the Dharma when you were 45 or something, or in my case when I was 29, maybe when we're born to a Buddhist family. And there are a lot of families in the West, none. Or very young, even if you're not born to a Buddhist family, having a mind that's always searching, you know, where is it? Where's my teacher? You know, what? There's children that even say that, you know, looking for their teacher. I know some of my fellow monks and nuns, one nun in particular said even when she was little, she used to think, she didn't know why. She says, who's, you know, I have to find my teacher. Not just mean like teacher of arts and crafts or something like that, but a spiritual teacher, her guru. Okay. Oh, okay. One other comment, then I'll keep on going after this. Yes.
So, question about why? I mean, it's just not fun ordinarily to want. Most people don't want to do this meditation, including people who've been practicing Buddhism for a lot of years.
Right. There's even a more unpopular one, meditation on the hell realms.
Yeah.
That tends to be even more unpopular. Right. But
it kind of freaks you out because, you know, I can remember Lama Zopa Rinpoche one time saying, you know, we're just one breath away from the hell realms.
Right.
You know, and that's like,
you don't understand
kind of
what that means.
Freak
right?
You out.
You just, if you take in one breath and you don't breathe out, the next moment you could be taken.
Could be in a,
probably in hell.
Could be in a very unfortunate realm where you would suffer for a very long time. So these meditations are they're hard to want to do on a daily basis. But I do remember one thing that, you know, and I don't know who said this, but it's good to remember death and impermanence in the beginning and in the middle and in the end. But again, don't want to do it.
Yeah. Well,
and I'm just looking at what that resistance and how to get through that, or okay, how to, because I see the power of it.
Yeah. So you can see that resistance in the minds of most people that are not, don't have a spiritual bent. They put off thinking about death. They try to, even because of the holding to permanence, they try to either think of them, like the Dalai Lama mentions here, when he talks to some old U.S. senators, he says, they're old. He says, oh, old friend. And they say, no, I'm not old. We've been friends for a long time. You shouldn't say I'm old. And he says, but they're really old. The hair coming out of their ears. I noticed in the last couple of years, but the hair coming out of my ears, but I have to shave the hair in my ears. Really old, you know. And so you don't, we don't have, it's almost as though we've never come to grips with death. And we are afraid of it. And so to bring it up brings fear in the mind. From a Buddhist perspective, like Milarepa, the great saint who attained enlightenment in one lifetime, meditating, he said, at the beginning, I meditated on death, the meditation on death and impermanence. And over time, I developed my mind. Now, if death comes, there's no fear. Whereas most people don't meditate on death, and so at the time of death, there's great fear. Or even approaching death, there's getting older, you know, desperately having operations to look younger, you know, and what is, in Christianity, what's it, one of the venal sins, was that vanity or something, right? Is that, what is it called? Venal sins? No, the deadly sins, deadly sins. Because we haven't meditated on death and impermanence. And with that, there's a little more ease with growing old, you know, or much more ease, depending on one's realization. Total calmness. And Lama Yeshe said, those who have meditated on death and impermanence and done the meditations that, say, sophisticated meditations that we yet have not yet meditated on, like, say, tantric meditations, to control the mind at the time of death, they, as death is approaching, it's like them going on a picnic. You know, like, oh, yeah, this is nice. It's coming up. No fear. And not only no fear, joy, because they're already prepared. So if we can, if by meditating on death now, we can overcome that tendency to ignore the teachings, we can practice, like the injuncture of the injunction of the second meditation, that the time of death is indefinite. I must practice now. If we practice now every day at the time of death, we could die with a very, you know, happy mind. You know, we don't need to have anything else other than that. So that's a very simple kind of thing. I think also, if you have, I don't think that David, the treasurer, is here tonight, is he? Is he hidden back there? So I'll mention during the weekend seminar about my 3-year retreat. He wanted me to mention about that. If you wanted to do retreat or to do practices, higher practices, or to even make realization of what we're practicing now, what's the fire? What's the energy that gives that, you know, that stick-to-itiveness and the perseverance to do that is a meditation on death and impermanence. So, yeah, that's what starts the spiritual practice, like you say, the beginning. That's what sustains it in the middle, and that's what culminates at the end, the practice, the meditation on death and impermanence. So that, yeah, that's a very good observation. So let me...
Do you have time for one more back here?
Okay. Why not?
Yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why not? Who's that? I don't see... Okay.
Venerable George, thank you very much for bringing the teaching to all of us. I cannot express how happy we are to have you here.
You just did. I'm just joking. Just teasing.
Maybe I can. My question for you is this. I have a daughter, and she has four living grandparents right now. And I think a lot of people are in this situation where their parents are having dementia, falling, the things that happen in geriatric sort of situations. And so none of these people are Buddhists other than myself. And, you know, so what can I do, death and dying wise, to help them, being my parents and in-laws, have a more peaceful death or a better rebirth or anything?
Right.
What's the most important thing that we can do in such a situation as we have parents and so on that are nearing
right.
a more certain end than my own?
Right. So if you have a chance to... This is a really good... There's the other books, I think... The little bit infamous Lama Sogyal Rinpoche was the supposed author of another book called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. But that's due to his motivations and so forth. It may not, karmically speaking, not so good. This is by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. It addresses that particular question in a couple of places in here. One of the most important things is not to... cause a person's mind to be distressed at the time of death. Not to bring a statue of the Buddha to your Catholic mother or, you know, your Jewish father or something like that and say, you know, save yourself, you know. It probably has happened in monasteries, you know, Christian monasteries, if an atheist or a Buddhist were to, When I went back to Chicago when my dad died, I went to a dentist, I wasn't wearing my robes. I came into the dentist's office to get an appointment. The dentist was there. His secretary said there was no time, and he said, no, I'll make time after the patients have left. So I went in at that time, and he put me in this seat and come back, and there on the ceiling was Jesus Christ, and lights and, you know, all sorts of things. And he sent me in a room beforehand while he was preparing where there were some Christian comic books about some guy who lost his way. He was practicing Zen. As though, you know, that from a Christian book, that was something like really bad. And at any rate, he was trying to save me. And so it was like rolled off me. It was not effective. but not to disturb the mind of the person, to help to bring up to them any particular spiritual practice they might have, to remind them of that, to bring their attention away from the thoughts of this lifetime, wanting to stay, that sense of, which is called permanent grasping, even though they're not thinking that it's permanent, it's though I want to keep it the way it is, even though it's inevitably changing. His Holiness had mentioned a couple of different instances where people died. In one case, it was a relative. In another case, it was some other people that he had encountered. He was asked to help, and they were not Buddhist. And that was the kind of thing. He tried to find out the particular, or there was a long verse by a Theravada teacher that this person was very fond of, who was dying of AIDS. And even though it was not something that Buddhists would find easy to remember, it brought comfort to him at that time. And the Dalai Lama just read the first line of it as he was passing away. And I think he said he could see his eyes underneath his closed lids kind of moving with some sense of peace. So if there's some practice that they've done to bring that up, to be kind and, not to make sure that there's no disturbances. Another thing His Holiness mentioned that in the hospital, sometimes when people are dying, there's a television on and there's like a violent show or something like this or, whatever, to let them have a quiet time and like that. In addition to just those things that come to mind right now to me, if you have a chance to read the teachings of the Dalai Lama, particularly about that, this is mainly talking about how we as practitioners can practice, but he also mentions how we can help others at the time of death. So, I don't have an awful lot of time, but I think out of responsibility. Steve, your regular teacher, had thought to read some of these verses from this text. So, again, part of it is talking about many things, death in general, but it's mainly talking about a text by the Panchen Lama, the first Panchen Lama, on how to deal with death, how to deal with the intermediate state between one death and the next life, and how to take rebirths like that. So I want to read a couple of the stanzas here. Okay, first stanza I'm going to skip, it's just general. I'll just put it back there. It has them in succession here. So this is the second stanza. May we extract the meaningful essence of this life. Support, that means this life of leisure and endowment or perfect human rebirth, the meaningful essence, without being distracted by the senseless affairs of this life. Since this good foundation, life, hard to gain and easy to disintegrate, it's quickly disintegrating, so it's integrating in here understanding of impermanence, presents an opportunity of choice between profit and loss, comfort and misery. So what that means is, Atisha himself had a very famous little stanza that he composed was, life is short, the objects to be known or experienced are infinite in number, so like the swan. Well, it needs a background. Swan, supposedly, if you were to pour milk in a pond water, the legend is, or the story is, the swan could, through its beak, pick up that pond water that has milk in it, let the water come out, and just keep the milk. You know, take the essence. So, he said, life is short. Constantly eroding. The objects that can be known and experienced are infinite. So like the swan, you have to be able to take the essence of this life without being distracted by the meaningless activities of this life, like the water. You know, the water is kind of like what ordinary people get involved in, but within that, there's the opportunity within our samsaric existence, to find the real essence of this lifetime. The essence of this lifetime is the ability to develop compassion, love, real love. Oftentimes when people say, I love you, I'm not sure. I think it's a little bit like, I love chocolate. Or like I love peanut butter, you know, pizza. It means, you please me. I'm saying this to you because if I please you too, we can, you know, make a pact, please each other. From a Buddhist perspective, that's not real love. That's wanting to get something for yourself, wanting to satisfy yourself. From a Buddhist perspective, real love is the basis for successful relationships, where you really care about the other person, want them to be happy. So this verse has, if you unpacked it, so to speak, commented on it, it has incredible depth. May we extract the meaningful essence of this life support, this life of leisure and endowment, without being distracted by the senseless affairs of this life. You might say, what senseless affairs? What are those? Well, most of what we get involved in, worry, I went to the knife store today or Bed Bath and Beyond, and I was trying to save some extra money with the coupons, cut out the coupon, you know. These are what, from a Buddhist perspective, if you had an understanding, if I had an understanding, an imminent realization of the time of death is indefinite, the death is definite, I wouldn't be so worried about those things. You know, I may save a little bit of money, but at the time of death, all that money's just going to be, you know, just go away. And I'm not going to be able to take it with me. May we extract the meaningful essence of this life support without being distracted by the senseless affairs of this life. Since this good foundation, hard to gain, like, I forgot your name, Jeff. Like Jeff was asking how, if we were to be born as a human again, not easy to create that karma. It requires a very powerful combination of karmic deeds to be born as a human again. So it's hard to find and easy to disintegrate, meaning every instance, it's not like we have to do, it's not like we have to bang a wall or scrape ourselves with a nail or something for the body to start to disintegrate. It's disintegrating by itself every instant, momentarily. Since this good foundation, hard to gain and easy to disintegrate, presents an opportunity of choice between profit and loss, comfort and misery. So what are the, that's talking about very common understanding in spiritual circles, even in practical circles, the deferral of gratification. Giving up the immediate profit for long-term profit. You know, understanding that if you create the causes right now for future happiness, it might cause you a little, in the short term, it might cause you some, like Don says, uncomfortable to meditate on death and permanence. But if you understand the value of that in the future, you'll put up with that discomfort. You know, I've got to do this because this is what will fire my practice. This is what will give me the energy to do a retreat at the end of my life, so I can die with some sense of accomplishment. Okay. There's more commentary to that, but I'll just read one other verse. This was verse number 2, stanza number 2 in this text by the Panchen Lama that the Dalai Lama is commenting on. Stanza 3. May we realize that there is no time to waste. So this is kind of talking about the time of death is indefinite, right? May we realize that there is no time to waste. Death being definite, but the time of death indefinite. What is gathered will separate. What has been accumulated will be consumed without residue. At the end of rising comes descent. And the finality of birth is death. This brings up these four famous points that the Buddha mentioned. Whatever comes together, like say friends, whatever friends you meet, whatever relatives you're born into, eventually you'll separate. Is that not true? Whatever you accumulate, wealth, baseball cards, coins, stamps, money, will eventually be, how did it put here? Whatever was gathered will separate. What has been accumulated will be consumed without residue. So you will use it up, or it will be lost to you in the future. The end of everything that rises is to fall. What do we say that in the West too, right? Whatever goes up goes down. Even the market, right? The finality of birth is death. So from the talk that we'll have on Wednesday, talking about the 12 links of dependent origination, that's one of the one of the links is called death with or without aging. You might think that once you're born, you're not going to age until you're, you know, what? How old are you, Jeff?
57.
Until you're 57. I was just teasing. Until you're 57, you're not aging. You're aging from the very moment of conception, as soon as the mind enters into the fertilized egg. So the end of birth is death. Sometimes it comes the next moment. The consciousness enters a fertilized egg, the next moment it leaves. So to contemplate on those helps in many ways. Let me just read you a little bit about that. This is stanza 3. Let's see if I can find that here. The Dalai Lama's commentary. I think that may have been, that stanza 4. There we go. Stanza 3. From beginningless time, the Dalai Lama says, we have been under the influence of an illusion of permanence. Technically, in the philosophical teachings, is called grasping to permanence. And it's the same way when we talk about emptiness, the defect, the basic ignorance, is what's called grasping to a self that doesn't really exist. Self-grasping. Have you ever heard that term? So this is subsidiary, permanent grasping. Grasping to permanence. We have a mind, because things don't appear to us as changing moment by moment, we have gotten accustomed to believing that, assenting to that, as though our mind, so the word grasping kind of means going along with, assenting to. Do you know what that word means, to assent? Like if there's a parliamentary debate, you're really not, you're going along with it, you're not completely invested, but you assent to that. So we assent to permanence, we're grasping to permanence. From beginning of time, we've been under the influence of an illusion of permanence. So we think there's always lots of time remaining. This puts us in great danger of wasting our lives in procrastination. To counteract this tendency, it is important to meditate on impermanence, on the fact that death might come at any moment. So, because our mind is so accustomed to that, it is uncomfortable to meditate on impermanence. So to give yourself, like Don, to give yourself some energy, I must meditate on this because I'm frankly still under the influence of grasping to permanence, to assenting to permanence. Even though there's no certainty you will die tonight, it's not certain you're going to die tonight, when you cultivate an awareness of death, you appreciate that you could die tonight. With this attitude, if there is something you can do that will help both this life and the next, you will give it precedence over something that will just help this life in a superficial way. I think that's a very, very powerful line. So with this attitude, if there's something you can do that will help both this life and the next, you know, so you can say, I'm going to stop at Sonic. I don't know if that's around here. I see the ads on TV. And get a milkshake. But if I just do, okay, I'm going to dedicate this first to the Buddha, the Dharma, Sangha. You do, you know, imagine offering to the Buddha out of emptiness is transformed into nectar. So you give precedence to that. With this attitude, if there's something you could do that will help both this life and the next, you drink your Sonic shake and you dedicate it to the Buddha, you will give it precedence over something that will just help this life in a superficial way. Furthermore, by being uncertain about when death will come, you will refrain from doing something that will harm both your present and future lifetimes. You know? Well, also, this gives you the energy also to abstain from, let's say, putting yourself in situations where you lose all conscientiousness, getting drunk, getting stoned, or, you know, your mind. Also, just letting yourself become hysterical about some loss in your life where you lose all sense of reason. You will refrain from doing something that will harm both your present and future lifetimes. As this sense of caution develops, you will strive harder not to accumulate unfavorable predispositions, you know, negative actions that leave an imprint in our mind, negative ones, through uncontrolled actions. You'll control yourself. Like the word Muni in the name Shakyamuni, the Buddha is called Shakyamuni Buddha, the previous Buddha. Muni means, one of the meanings of that, it's not just sage, but controlled one. So when we say, Om Tadyata Munye Munye Maha Munye Asva, it's like, oh, controlled one who has control over the, you know, certain delusions. Muni Muni Maha Munya, great control. So you'll be motivated. As this sense of caution develops, you will strive harder not to accumulate unfavorable predispositions through uncontrolled actions. You'll control yourself a little more, but not in the sense that we sometimes think, oh, there's the person who ruins the party, you know, they look so conservative, they're so controlled, they don't want to take the heroin or they don't want to snort the coke or something. Maybe that's good, you know, that you don't. You'll be motivated to develop, according to your ability, attitudes that act as antidotes to the various forms of an untamed mind. Then, whether you live a day, a week, or a month, or a year, that time will be meaningful. Right now, we might pass the next week, month, year not practicing. Our life will be sort of superficial, in meaningless activities. That time will be meaningful if you think of death, you're more controlled, your thoughts and actions will be based on what is beneficial in the long run, and the longer you live, the more beneficial they will be. Okay, so I think, is it 8:30 or 9? 8:30, right, so, I mean, when we end, 8:30, yeah. So, just a couple minutes over, but thanks for your attention. I think Steep will continue next week. If you get a chance, I really recommend this. I believe you can probably get it also as a ebook and put it on your, I have it on my iPad also, which is very useful. A very nice thing on those pads, at least on the Apple one, you can say invert colors. Have you ever done that? So that a white page is black with the white letters rather than white. At night when I do my prayers in my loft in my meditation cabin, I have my iPad there, and so it's black with just the letters, so it doesn't use as much, the battery will last longer if you don't have it plugged in, and it's just easier on the eyes, so you can read this book. And also, if you have a companion in bed, if you're reading in your iPad, it won't be so bright to disturb them. So let's do a very short dedication of the merit that we've created this evening. So if you again relax your body, relax your mind, see if you can recall that clear spaciousness of the mind. Let go of the thoughts. And within that clarity, recognize that we've created some virtuous karma tonight because of a positive motivation at the beginning, because of listening to the teachings of the Dalai Lama and the Buddha in general. We may have been moved to have some remarkable thoughts of, oh, I can do that. I can meditate. I should do that. Maybe thoughts of compassion or love. We've created some virtuous karma that will definitely ripen on our continuum within cyclic existence. So we want to dedicate that, preserve that for that goal of our spiritual development, for the welfare of others. In whatever way this karma ripens, may it, you know, make a strong wish. May it ripen in such a way that it always enhances my kindness, my patience, my spiritual development, life by life, if it need be. Always leaving me in a state where I consider others more important than myself, up until including the state of enlightenment. Supreme enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. Due to these merits, may I quickly become fully enlightened Buddha for the sake of all mother sentient beings. Thank you very much. So there's a... If you're welcome to attend on Wednesday, if you like. There's a talk on... last week we talked about the Four Noble Truths. We'll continue to finish a little about that and the 12 Links of Dependent Origination. And this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there'll be a course on the Mahamudra. So that might be interesting. So thank you. Don't die on the way home. If you can avoid it.